pastor of the Evangelical Church of the Czech Brethren, got his doctorate in Prague, who was visiting professor at the Greifswald University in East Germany, and since 1968 has been a professor at the Comenius Faculty of Protestant Theology in Prague. And most of his main publications are in German, the Faith of Grief and Gnosis, the Epistle to the Ephesians and Gnosis, Die Bergpredigt, the Sermon on the Mount, the Gottessohn, the Son of God, the Entstehung der Christologie, the Origin of Christology, and one English title here, the Gospel of Thomas. And I have a note that he has just finished a German commentary on Colossians in the Hauptkommentare zum Neuen Testament series. They'd be interested. He is married, has four children. He just told me his daughter is going to be married shortly when he returns now to Czechoslovakia. So we have to be back in about a month for that. But he has four children altogether. His wife is a psychologist. He will address us tonight on the topic, the intention of Colossians. Dr. Fulton.
Thank you. The advantage of the oral communication, gives us the opportunity to concentrate on the most important issue, and it compels us to express the intention of a working commentary in a short time, to summarize it, even for myself. It's important. On the other hand, it's of course it has of course its disadvantages. Namely, it's always simplifying, so that I apologize for this simplifying just in advance. I try to stress the intention by underscoring some general currents of the structure of the epistle to the Colossians. I have divided my lecture in four parts. The first one is the literary surface, the structure of the Colossians. It's always an important task to divide the literary macrostructure into smaller units, since this subdivision says a lot about the content itself. In Colossians, we can clearly observe some major paragraphs inside this letter. The first larger paragraph goes until the first chapter from the verse 1 until 23. That's clear, that's a prayer. At the beginning, a prayer of thanksgiving, then a prayer for the Colossians, and at the end it's a prayer of thanksgiving again, so that at the surface we get a A-B-A structure. But in fact the second prayer of thanksgiving is a part of the intercession prayer for the Colossians. It's a model how they should be able to give thanks to God. And inside this prayer for the Colossian Christians, there is a quotation of a hymn, generally accepted by most of the scholars, accepted all the material in this epistle, Colossians 1:15-20. It can be divided into two verses and one intermezzo, one sub-verse. This is the first part. The second one has less obvious structure, but we can nevertheless observe a switch from the most, from the passage formulated most in the second person of plural, you Colossians, into the first person of singular in chapter 1:24-2:5, where Paul is apologizing his own apostleship and stressing his apostolic authority by reminding the addressees on his chains and his being in prison for the sake of Jesus Christ. And then is another part which is clearly understood as a larger unit, which is of course some subunits. I wouldn't go near into the details. But with 2:6, a discourse starts, where the sender addresses the Colossians, the addressees, again in second person of plural, and is discussing a kind of problem. It's not quite a clear discussion of some question that would be formulated at the beginning, like for example in Paul's letters to Colossians, where the problem is formulated about the resurrection of the hope for those who die before the new age, or about problem of marriages, or get married or not get married, and the problem of meat that has been sacrificed to the idols. But still we can recognize inside the in the frame of the generally paranetic oriented discussion a polemics that several times attacks a third group, a third actant in this discourse. This kind of literary sub-jam goes until the end of the second chapter. In 3:1, the text became explicitly paranetic. The mood change into from the polemics against a third group, from statements about the faith, into exhortation. They are imperatives mostly, beginning with 3:1 and going till about 4:6. But inside this structure, we see another substructure, the so-called house tafel, beginning in 3:18 and going to until 4:1. This a little, let's say, awkward placing of the house table, maybe due to the fact that Colossians is the oldest Christian piece of literature, including such a sub-genre, so that the author had to look for some placing into this wider literary setting of his epistle. And then, of course, the last part are the final greetings, 4, 7 till 18. So that the epistle has, in fact, in verse 18, the second ending. The first ending is in 3:17, then came when the house table comes, then the greetings, and then a second ending of it. Inside this structure we can observe one key motive that keeps these units together. This key motive is formulated most explicitly in the second chapter, verse 12 and 13. You were dead in your transgressions. I don't like to translate it into my bad English. I think you understand at least my English. I shall read it in the Hebrew Bible of Jerusalem. Yes. You have been buried with him when you were baptized, and by baptism too you have been raised up with him through your belief in the power of God who raised him from the dead. You are dead because you are sinners and have been not circumcised. He has brought you to life with him. He has forgiven us all our sins. This is a dual statement, in fact parallel, even in spite of the fact that the metaphors are not quite the same. There are differences in the image here, but still let's take it as a whole. The statement about baptism as death and resurrection with Jesus Christ, which is a kind of practical application of what has been quoted in the hymn in the first chapter about Jesus, who is the first born from the dead. That's an application of this older material on the Colossian congregation, Christian community, and the problems they had at the time. But this theme repeats several times. The first chapter is the older background, the most specific interpretation, new formulation we find in 2, 12 and 13. But we can see once more again in 2:20. If you have really died with Christ to the principles of this world, why do you still rules dictate to you so you are still living in the world? A rhetoric question, reassuming this statement from 2:12 or 2:13. And once more we read it in 3:1. Since you have been brought back to true life with Christ, you must look for the things that are in heaven, where Christ is sitting at God's right. That's a clear allusion on this basic statement in 2:12. And once more in 3:12. In 3:12 we read, you are God's chosen race, his saints. He loves you and he loves you, and you should be crossed in sincere compassion. Oh, sorry, that's the third. Once more in this chapter. Yes, this this well, it's still life. You know, I've got children, right? He's saying he loves you and you should be crossed in sincere compassion and so on. The imagery of being crossed is an analogy, clear analogy to the rebirth in with Jesus Christ. It's an analogy to the baptismal procedure. They were mostly being baptized snakes, the early Christians. Crossing of the new cross after the baptism is here a clear allusion on the basic statement. The importance of this basic statement is deduced not only from the fact that it repeats several times and that it goes across two literary different parts of the epistle. That means across the discursive part to the parenetic part, and that it reassumes a motive mentioned in the introductory prayer, the first part. But it's important just because it's a new formulation, a reformulation of what we read in Romans 6. In Romans 6 we read about Romans 6 verse 3 till 10 about. We read about, we read to the about the same procedure of baptism, but here it's formulated another way. You who were baptized in Jesus Christ, you are baptized into his death. You were buried with him through the baptism into his death. In order that you may live peripatei in the newness of life as he was, as he has been raised from death. And the second time it's repeated in verse 8. We have died with Jesus, with Christ, and we believe that we will live with him. The dying with Christ is the present act. The rising with him is in the future. Or the dying with Jesus is the present act, and the answer is the present earthly life in the light of his resurrection. Whereas in Colossians and in the same time in Ephesians, but I consider Ephesians to be written after Colossians, so that this could be continuation of this tradition, elaboration or taking over of the Colossian tradition. Here we see a shift of emphasis. You are already raised with Jesus Christ. In Ephesians even, you are already sitting on the right of God. That's the major shift of emphasis, And in the same time, it's the leading motif of the Epistle of Colossians. We have seen the clear major parts of the epistle, and in the same time we were able to follow this new stress being, let's say, a theological bracket keeping together the macro structure of the epistle. That's the first general observation. Let's start the second step of our discussion, namely consideration concerning the discursive structure. The, one of the very most simple ways how to analyze the discursive text, not narrative text, is to reconstruct the positions of the various partners of this discussion. That means, let's start with the author as the first actor, like the structuralists call it. The author, or in fact the authors, since its senders are indicated Paul and Timotheus, like for example in 2 Corinthians. The senders, generally spoken, write a little different language than the undeniable Pauline epistles, Pauline homologumena. There is lots of long sentences, very long sentences, appositions. There are differences not only in the syntax but also in the vocabulary. Lots of these differences, however, can be explained by the fact that there are some hymnic materials being taken over here. But in fact, we can prove the pre-Colossians unit only in the hymn. In the other parts, we can discover only some liturgical sentences, groups of expressions, so that the latest monograph that is dealing with the vocabulary and style of Colossians by the German scholar Walter Puyar comes to the conclusion that the style of Colossians is not polar. I know one person can change its style during the life after some years, but still they are some subconscious elements of the language that are very different to be altered even by growing older or being influenced by the language of the addressees or opponents. So that we have to suppose here, very generally formulate, it's at least a very different Paul. Let's call him metaphorically the older Paul, which causes lots of difficulties, I know, since because of the similarity of the greeting list, we have to put Colossians near Philemon, so that we cannot make Paul so old. But let us push these problems aside at this moment and simply formulate as another Paul. It may be we may formulate it together with Edward Schweitzer, that here most probably one of his pupils, Schleicher is convinced that it was Timotheus who has formulated this letter, so that that would be the reason why the Pauline thinking is so put in such a different way here. But nevertheless, it's a later Paul, and for us it's theologically important. There are theologically important two features of this later or older Paul. Theologically it's Paul, so that we can call him Paul and discuss this difference is only in the last passage as addition to the main thesis even of my explanation. But there are two major features. One, this Paul has performed this shift in the interpretation of the oldest evangelion of the gospel about dying and rising of Jesus Christ. That was the very primitive formula of the Christian faith. We meet it elaborated in the 1 Corinthians 15 in the formula of faith, but we meet it also in this very simple way, for example, in the oldest Pauline epistle, 1 Thessalonians 4:13, I think, where we read about Jesus who has died and has been raised up. And we know that since the classical Paul, since the undeniable Paul in Romans 6, this formula was applicated to the baptismal rite, so that the ritual of baptism was explained as dying with Jesus Christ and getting the hope of being raised with him. So it was, so was the Pauline idea about the baptism. And this older Paul, this Paul of Colossians, has stressed the fact, or maintains simply, that we have been already raised with Jesus Christ. There are lots of feedbacks or fuses. For example, we are raised with him in faith. It's not yet the full reality, and there are some individual expressions of the future hope, but just from the first chapter there is another emphasis. Our hope is already deposited in the heavens. It's there. The eschatological prospect of the classical Paul is simply telescoped into the present situation of the believer. And the second major feature of this older Paul is his intensive communicating with the addressees through his disciples, through his pupils. There is a mention about Epaphras in first chapter, and there are lots groups and almost generations of his disciples who are approaching the Colossian congregation. The second group involved in the discussion, in the discuss, are the addressees. The addressees are, well, Colossians, but not only Colossians, practically. There is more times, several times, note about Laodiceans as the addressees. The Colossians have to lend this letter to the Laodiceans, and they are four times mentioned, more than the Colossians themselves. There is about the Laodiceans we can read in 2:1, 4:13. 4:15 and 4:16. There is special feature is that they are born from the Pauline mission through Epaphroditus. So watching them spiritually, very carefully, through his disciples, his community. The community is defined in Colossians 2:5 as a very special group. Paul is glad seeing their taxes, their order. He has heard about the Ecclesiastes people stress on the order again, the Gnostic disorder. They are living orderly and they are firm in faith. But there is, in the verse 4, in the fourth verse, just before, a strange illusion, a notion about the danger that they could be shaken, maybe shaped by deceived by fine sounding arguments. There is an inattention between these two statements. They are firm in faith, they are orderly, but some fine sounding argument could shake them, deceive them. Seems like the verse 5 would be an idol image of the Ephesians. And verse 4, alluding in a method of the Patitinium ex event to the prophesying from what has already happened, been describing the present situation since the polemics against the adversaries, against the enemies, who are not yet there. But they are described as the great danger for the congregation. Is fitting into this picture of the possible seduction by this fine sounding arguments, so that we can define the other partners of this dialogue, discuss the addressees as Paul's people from the Pauline mission who are endangered by some outer opponents or heretics, let's say, with the later terminology, and who in the same time haven't yet performed the shift in Pauline theology, the shift stressing the present participation in the salvation through faith, the resurrection with Jesus. The addressees are Pauline people having not yet performed this shift and being endangered by another third group. And what about the third group? We read about them in 2:23, that first, that they are teaching something like wisdom, that seems to be a wisdom, teaching about wisdom, Sophia. And it's most probably because of this danger that the sender stresses in 2:3 then that all Sophia and all hidden knowledge, gnosis, is contained in Jesus Christ. That are two sides of the same coin, I think. In 2:8, this other movement is being leveled as philosophia, which doesn't mean anything bad, but it doesn't mean philosophy in the today's sense. It means philosophia was every teaching, every movement having a teacher and his disciples. But still, this philosophia in 2:8 is against labeled as how it's called in English. Second hand, well, trapping, yes. Don't let me trapped by this philosophy. And it's being in the same time leveled as teaching according to the elements, poikeia, of the work. The elements of the work is also a very wide term that has a wide variety of meanings in the Hellenistic world. But anyhow, we have to start the explanation of this term from the analogies in Galatians. In Galatians 4, 3 and 9, these toicheia are, at least in one case of these two occurrences, are identical with the Mosaic law. This doesn't mean that toicheia are the Mosaic law even here, but it means that the toicheia, certainly, since the sender, even if it's a literary, another hand as Paul, has to be considered as Pauline in theology. It was the program of this letter to be Pauline, so that he has derived his arguments from Galatians. And it most probably, this toicheia have here the same function like the Mosaic law in Colossians. That means they are something between man and God. Like in Paul, the Mosaic law is as soon as it becomes more important than separating the people from God himself. It's an obstacle of faith. It has to be replaced and can be replaced by faith, so that the faith can make a direct connection with God. But this toicheia can mislead the Christians, and they try to convince them that they have to do this diversion through the toicheia, so that the toicheia is in both Galatians and Colossians term designated some mediating way, indirect way, between the from the believer to God or from God to the believer. And of course, the most difficult notion is the last one in the last verse of the second chapter. Once more, we come into the verse 23. There is a mention there about tapein of rosine, about the humbleness, which means most probably ascetic attitude towards life. And in this place, there is a difficulty with translating this verse. But let's stop with the Characteristic of the opponents in 218. In 218 we read two expressions from the mystery religions, Embatelo and Horan, view the mysteries, and Embatelo meant, among others, the trespassing the threshold of the telesterion of the place when the initiation has been performed. But we read here also about the Gnostics as those who worship the angels. This could be understood as a participation in the angelic worship, heavenly worship, where angel worship God himself. That's the solution of Frederick Francis. But still more probably is the translation according to which the angeloi are the object, I think it's in English too, of the worship, and the opponents, the third part, are in fact slandered by the sender as those who worship angels. That means who worship some mediators between man and God. Those who have been involved in the Gnostic studies have already discovered some analogies with Gnosticism and the opponents here. I wouldn't dare to say that these are Gnostics, since we have no evidence of Gnostic worship of angels. We even had some polemics about worshipping of angels in the Gnostic, polemized against the Christians who worship the angels, the Catholic Church. But still, there are some analogies in many Gnostic writings concerning the difficulties of the Gnostic in ascending to the highest deity. Since the individual spheres above this world were considered to be partially fighting against the man and being inimical, or how is the expression, against the believer. And the Gnostic had to learn the various words that were enabling him to pass the guards of the individual spheres. They are in the books of Yehu, there are even graphical pictures about the guards, and they have to pass them. And in the Gospel of Thomas we have some individual saying that may fit into this picture about if you are asked you have come from, we have to answer, we have come out of the light, and then probably they will be able to pass higher, and then another question comes. So that this may be, I tell it tentatively, this may be a certain analogy, not the heresy, but a religious phenomenological analogy to what was demanded by the opponents as the essential towards the higher spiritual principle, is whom the initiated Gnostics were in fact identical in their substance. So that the we have to suppose that the first encounter of Christianity and Gnosticism wasn't any encounter of direct polemics. The Gnostics most probably explained their teaching as a higher insight into the hidden mysteries, whereas the Christian faith in their opinion, only a lower expression of it, and they supposed to give a general principle explanation what's behind Jesus and Adonis and the individual mystery deities. Like it's hinted, for example, in the last and tractate in Hippolyte. So that the danger wasn't a danger of enemies coming against the Christians, but a danger misleading the Christian congregations through allegedly higher kind of interpretation of faith, discovering the way of escape from this fatal prison in this world. We have heard that Gnostics underestimated the human sin and explained the difficult situation of the man by faith, by the pre-human fall that has been done in the divine word. Well, that's what I am just hinted now. It could be supported by the fact that the Gnostics judge the opponents judge the others 2:16. That's in fact the most concrete moral argument against them. That means they consider themselves higher than the other Christians, or they katabrabeway, they disqualify their faith in 2:18. Well, let's mention at the end of the second part, I'm almost closing now, let's mention that both these groups, the sender and the opponents, have also their supporters. That means some texts that are not absolutely identical with their opinion, but they can be used to explain and favor their position. For the senders, it's the hymn in 1:15-20. That's the supporter. It's not direct argument in favor of, it's not identical what the senders say, Paul and Timotheus, but still it's being used as the supporter. And the opponents that, of course, also they support us, the human traditions, but there is no further indication what these traditions mean. But nevertheless, there was some background in legends or myths that the opponents were developing. And now the problem and the solution can be answered very quickly. The third part, in fact, the property of the epistle, what's the matter here? Against the tendency to bind the human salvation on a higher and hidden knowledge and make it dependent of some mediators or practices enabling to surmount these obstacles that are in fact fully being surmountable, to overcome only for those who are initiated into this higher knowledge. the senders stress that the Christians have immediate access to the Savior in their faith. This seems to be at a glance a spiritualistic solution. They can escape directly to the Lord in faith. In fact, it's a new interpretation of the Pauline stress on faith, justifying faith. It's a static image of the justification by faith on the final judgment, since the justification by faith in Romans, for example, means the justification in the future judgment of God. But here, the faith means to be able to communicate immediately with the deposit that inhabits it. It's changed into a static space image. But it isn't an absolutely, let's say, escapist image, since this shift of emphasis that in some respect decreases the eschatologic tension, the shift of emphasis is being balanced by a stress on the real, concrete coexistence in the body of church, that is Jesus' body. To meet Jesus doesn't mean to leave this earthly life. It means to enter the visible community of Christians, of the Christian congregation, Christian community, body of Christ. It's several times stressed, underscored in the epistle. It means in the same time to create a concrete social unit, so that the more the present salvation is being stressed, the more is developed the parenetic part of the letter. I think that's almost a law in the development of the later Pauline thinking or Pauline school. On the one hand, present salvation, but it has to be balanced by concrete and developed parenetic material that's able even to cope with the setting of the other world, to take over some social values, moral values of the outer world, and to baptize them and to support them from the core of the faith. That's one, I think, important evolution. And of course, that means also morally not to judge the others, to leave the judgment to God. I think we can see a certain analogy of this shift and the development of the Christian teaching in the Johannine school. There are several analogies. For example, in John 5:14, we read that who believes will not stand in the face of God and His judgment, but He's just passed from the death to the life, present salvation, John 5:40. Nevertheless, we can observe that there are some such tendencies among the opponents of 1 Corinthians 14, 4, 4th chapter, 1 Corinthians, Paul is polemizing against people who consider themselves to be already enjoying the good part of the Beatitudes on the Sermon on the Mount. They are already full, they are reigning as kings, they are already wise, whereas we are still fools, says Paul, isn't it? So that it was a very dangerous shift to be observed here, that has to be read only in the connection with the authentic Pauline development. We even see, and now I am entering the last part, very short remark, excuse me. Sorry, I have no blackboard here, but well, there is, if you consider the Pauline corpus, and now there are two groups of later letters, pastoral epistles and Colossians Ephesians. From the Pauline homologumena, the undeniable letters of Paul, we can follow a quite logical, theological development towards Colossians Ephesians, what have been the monstances. On the other hand, we can see a quite logical development from Paul to the pastoral epistles, in different place and maybe in a little different time, but still it's a later Paul. But what we can see, there is an almost unbridgeable gap in the stresses between the pastoral epistles and the Colossians Ephesians. In second in the second Timotheus 2:18, we read the polemics against the followers of Hymenaeus and Philetus, most probably also some Gnostics, or some people that are understandable on the Gnostic model, who declare that the resurrection has already happened. It seems to be the same heresy like the official teaching of Colossians and Ephesians, as will these two groups of epistles combine themselves. I wouldn't like to maintain it, but still we have to be aware of this tension. That means there were some developments in the Pauline school according to the new situations and new danger, and it was possible to react against the same danger in various ways by stressing that salvation is in the future and by supporting some element traditions of the church. Or on the other hand, by stressing, yes, we have all already in Jesus Christ, the common denominator is only the significance of the Christian community, of the real life of the Christian community. Eucharist, baptism, and the daily life of the Christian community. That's the common denominator, but the theological structure is quite different, so that I think this difference is an argument in favor of the later Deuteropauline origin of both pastoral epistles and Colossians and Ephesians. Since if there were one of these branches, a real Pauline one, then the imitators, the disciples of Paul, wouldn't dare to write letters in his name just in such a different way. The only explanation is that both branches are fruit of the same four-line movement in various settings, in various situations, maybe in different times. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't consider them authentic four-line.